Hi, this is Joe Castellano. Welcome to the Inside China Basin Baseball Podcast on thesportsvirus.com, featuring players like all-star catcher Buster Posey.
It's about, you know, just going out and trying to have passion for the game that I've loved since I was a kid.
Inside China Basin is brought to you by Sun First Solar, known for delivering solar excellence since 1984 and recently voted best solar company in Marin County. We're also brought to you by TPC Harding Park, the only public golf course in San Francisco offering golfers the opportunity to play where the pros play. Today we're going to talk to former Giants reliever Jeremy Affeldt, who won three World Series rings with the San Francisco Giants. But first, I want to tell you about our favorite golf course, TPC Harding Park. And unfortunately, right now, Harding Park is closed per Mayor Breed's shelter-in-place order, like a lot of places right now. We will have more information about that on future podcasts. Also, our other sponsor, I want to tell you about Kane's Tire, is actually open. So good news there. And for Kane's Tire to remain open during this unfortunate time, they're practicing social distancing and being available to the community, providing tire and brake services to ensure necessary safety to daily driving. So if you need tires, stop by Kane's Tire for your tire and brake needs. They're open regular hours. Well, the sports virus, the name the sports virus, people have been asking me a little bit about that. I consider this to be the good virus, and hopefully we'll be able to entertain you a little bit with these podcasts while you're sitting there at home and waiting for all of this to end. So I really appreciate you listening to the podcast and a very special guest today in Jeremy Affeldt, and hopefully many more as we go along each week with Inside China Basin, our baseball podcast, wondering when the Major League Baseball season is going to get underway. I know it's hard for everybody, but hang in there and hopefully this helps a little bit. So coming up, we'll hear from former Giant Jeremy Affeldt right after this. Jones goes back near the wall, shading the sun, and he dropped it. He lost the ball in the sun. Let's put the sun to good use at home with a SunPower residential solar system. Your SunPower elite dealer, SunFirst Solar, has a wide range of financing options, and they provide the finest customer service from start to finish, regardless of size or scope. SunFirst Solar offers the highest efficiency systems, newest technology, and the best warranty in the world. SunFirst Solar offers the most competitive price while not compromising on quality. This summer, let the sun heat your pool and eliminate your energy bill. Don't drop the ball. Call SunFirst Solar at 415-458-5870. That's 415-458-5870. And get your SunPower solar system today. On Thursday morning, I had a chance to talk with former Giants left-hander Jeremy Affeldt, who had really incredible numbers when you think about it in the postseason in his career. 33 appearances, 31 and a third innings, 3 earned runs, a 0.86 ERA. In the last 23 innings that he pitched, he didn't give up any runs. And in the World Series, 11 and two-thirds innings, 1 run allowed, 0.77 ERA. Talked about today's baseball, and we went down memory lane. Here's a conversation I had on Thursday with Jeremy Affeldt. Well, Jeremy, thanks a lot for joining us. A lot of people are sitting home, and I think this will help a little bit to kind of go down memory lane. And I wanted to start with, you know, I've been thinking about this lately, just being home for the last week, the adjustment that Major League players have to make when they retire. And you've gone through retirement, and, you know, you slid into the broadcasting field, and I'm sure that was a nice transition to be able to make right away. But for a lot of players, I mean, it's not easy to go from being on the field and the excitement of that, the intensity of that, and try to replace that in retirement. So how do you deal with it? How did you? And what about some of your teammates that have retired?
Be honest with you, man, I still don't think I've dealt fully with it. It's a really hard transition. It's 5 years now, and I'm still trying to figure out what I'm wanting to do. And I think the tough thing a lot of times for some guys, not all guys, but some guys, when they played long enough in the game, they financially made enough money where they don't have to do anything, right?
Yeah.
So, but the tough part of that is some of those guys are like 35, 33, 36, 37. You can't not do anything. But it's hard because you're trying to figure out what you want to do, but you don't have to, there's no sense of urgency to find something to do. And so then you go from all of that to, but you don't want to be 37 years old and just sitting around playing golf all day. Like, that can't happen. Like, there's no way a player that was driven to compete as hard as we're driven to compete and to go into a situation where we're just not competing and now we have no agenda and we have no goals, and to transition into something like that and then try to figure out how to regen that up or try to find a new hobby or even a new type of business. It's very hard to do. And I think anybody that's ever transitioned or retired would be able to tell you, it doesn't matter if you do it when you're 35 or do it when you're 60, 65. When you do something for so long and then all of a sudden it stops, it's really hard to not still want to do it. And that's why you do see a lot of guys get into the media world and talk about the game or coaching. I mean, I used to actually think when I played, like, what are these guys, they run businesses, they have a business and they made $100 million. Why would they start a business? Well, when you retire, you figure out that because they need something to do. You know, they need something to keep them active, to keep their brain going, to give them goals. And we're so trained a certain way to compete and win and have goals that that's what we do. We start a business, or like I'm in the process now. In the next, over the next few months or a year, I'm going to start a brewery here in Texas where I'm at because I enjoy breweries. I enjoy what they mean to the community. I enjoy what they mean to give back scenarios and you know, being a part of the 21st Amendment, doing fundraisers there, it has really stirred something in me. And I want to have a brewery that does well and it has good beer, but also brings a good and community environment. So it's kind of like, that's what I'm about. So that's what I want to try to create. I want to try to create a community of people that enjoy hanging with each other and can go chat about life in a safe environment over a beer and stuff like that. So it is something you just say, yeah, I just want to start something new. I want to try something. But I also want to be a part of baseball because it's kind of ingrained in me, and I want to give some of my advice or even in my thoughts of what I see from a perspective of a guy that didn't play 30 years ago but played 5 years ago. And so that's why I'm a part of that media world in baseball because of that perspective. So it's fun, but it's also very confusing and very difficult, to be honest with you.
Well, that is really cool about the brewery. I wish you the best of luck on that one. And as far as the broadcasting is concerned, tell us about, you know, going into it after being a player. It seems like a natural transition, but a lot of people don't realize that broadcasting is not easy. Tell us a little bit about your broadcasting journey and what you'd like to do in the future.
Well, I enjoyed broadcasting. I actually enjoyed doing everything about it. I didn't stop doing broadcasting on my own desire. I, to be perfectly honest with you, I don't really hide a whole lot of it. That the team president and I had a difference of opinion. He didn't think my heart was in it, and I thought it was. And I wanted more games, and he didn't want me to come back. And there's no rhyme or reason to why he did what he did, in my opinion. He just didn't. He said he wanted to go a different route, which I thought was very unfortunate. And to me, he didn't use wisdom in that decision. But I do think that I did like what I got after that. I got some YouTube talent. The YouTube games on TV, which was phenomenal. I got to do with Eric Burns, and we had a great time. It was super fun, and I've enjoyed those games. I'm looking forward to doing. I actually think I have a few more of those games. Well, I had them on the docket this year. Now we're trying to figure out the schedule based on this adjustment of doing more of those games. So I really enjoyed the broadcasting side of it. I still do. Unfortunately, it's not with the Giants, but it'll be, you know, if it's the YouTube, I'll get to see. Some of the way YouTube does it is that they like to have guys do TV stuff for a team they played for. So for me, luckily, I have the Rockies, Royals, Reds, and Giants in those kind of games. And if I have, you know, if a YouTube is pulling some of those games, I might have an opportunity to call those games. So I've been super excited about it. I do enjoy it because I do think it allows me to give my perspective on what I see and also perspective on what's really happening in the game. And I understand what goes on from a bullpen perspective. I understand how we watch the game. So for me, I enjoy giving a perspective from a bullpen mind on how I'm seeing the game unfold and how we're approaching hitters and different things like that. So I really enjoyed it. I hope I get to do more of it, but we'll see down the road.
I mentioned earlier that TPC Harding Park is closed right now, but when they open up, here's more information about the golf course. As I was thumbing through Golf Digest, I found that TPC Harding Park is recognized as one of the best places to play in America. And that didn't surprise me too much because I love the majestic layout and beautiful amenities. My San Francisco resident card gives me a great rate at TPC Harding Park, and I get to play where PGA Tour icons Jack Nicklaus, Phil Mickelson, and Tiger Woods have played. Now, if I can only score like them, okay, I'll stop dreaming and get to our guest. You know, you mentioned how the schedule is up in the air, and everything is up in the air right now in our entire country, and the sports world is no exception. And, you know, with baseball, everybody's so used to a routine. You know how it is with spring training, and these guys were getting close to being ready for the regular season, and now they're just sitting there. What would you do in this situation, Jeremy? What have you heard about players, what they're doing to try to stay ready for when there is a season?
Oh, well, I can tell you one thing. I don't know. I think it's uncharted territory for everybody. I really do. I think it's situations where how do we train for this? If they're going to start, they're mentioning now April 6th, the season starts. Well, to me, it's like, well, man, how does that work? Like, I guess you're going to have to just say, hey, man, it's spring training for everybody. Everybody's still getting used to it. You got to run. Maybe they'll give you some extra guys to start the season where you can have like 30 guys or something just because there might not be some arms developed yet. But, man, you know, have to run it as, I mean, it's tough because you have free agency years coming up and they don't want their numbers to suffer if they have to kind of start out slow. And there's a lot of stuff that goes into play and how you're doing workouts. Can we go as a team? If we only have groups of 10, if you're only allowed to have 10 people in an area at a time, well, can we say, okay, well, we're going to have our 30 guys that we know are going to either make the team or close, and they come in for 2 hours, three different times a day in groups of 10. And work. I mean, it's going to be really weird. Or do you let them work out at home? Do you let them go back? I mean, it's a very confusing time in sports. I think everybody's going to have to make the adjustment. The good thing is, it's not just one team, right? Everybody. So, my biggest concern would be more for the pitchers, their arms being ready, competing, getting their arms going, and so it kind of keep those pitchers' arms ready is probably the biggest thing. I think hitters getting their bat speeds up to par. Stuff like that, you can probably do that a little bit better than, you know, pitchers pitching under real-time stress is a little different on their arms. So it just depends on how teams are going to want to work it. I'm sure they're having all the specialists and all the guys come in and try to figure this all out. But it is going to be uncharted waters for all the sports, especially Major League Baseball, to kind of hit it at a really tough time.
Yeah, I'm probably looking at an abbreviated season, not 162 games, so that'll right. be different. You know, I wonder if this also takes the focus a little bit off the Astros, because when the season started, I was thinking, you know, everywhere they go, they're going to get booed. I mean, I guess that would happen anyway here, but maybe the focus is taken off of that. I wondered about your reaction. I know I've heard a little bit. You did an interview with KNBR, and you talked a little bit about it, but just every player out there who wasn't on the Astros, I can only imagine what they think of what they were doing with the cheating. And I wonder also how widespread it might have been, more so than just the Astros doing that.
Well, I think that's what you've got to evaluate. And all these players that are hitting the Astros, or they're talking bad about the team and stuff like that, you got to be real careful. You know, I think there's a good value system out there. There's a good quote that says, be careful about removing the speck out of someone else's eye before you move the plank out of your own eye. You know, because the thing is you have to remember, I don't think that the Astros is the only one. And I'm not saying that there's a lot of teams that were orchestrating it, but that doesn't mean there's players on end of the teams that aren't cheating in some way, shape, or form. Relay, you know, all that stuff. So you want to point out the Astros and call them out and hit them and tell them how bad they are. Okay, there's going to be a point there on that, but there's other points of like, okay, well, come on, man. Like, if cheating is cheating. So how else do you cheat? I don't know. Are pitchers putting stuff on the ball? Are they using other? You know, there's all kinds of stuff that you can qualify as cheating. I think the toughest thing about this is they were using electronics that no team could avoid, right? That was the biggest thing for me. Is like, it wasn't like, you know, like a pitcher could have said, well, I could just not put something on the ball, and that's my own moral decision. Or we got to be better at relaying signs from the catcher. We got to be ready at different signs. Maybe I got to quit working on see how I'm tipping my glove or how I'm tipping pitches. Those kind of things are like controllable, right?
Yeah.
Well, this is an uncontrollable because no team could have avoided it. If they're using the technology for the replay to use to relay signs, that's actually, like, to me, that's pretty bad because you can't avoid that. There's no team that can adjust accordingly to that. So that, to me, is where it's tough on that. But, you know, if you want to go after the players that did it, okay, you know, you can hit them. Is it going to solve anything to hit somebody? No, it doesn't. It doesn't. You want to hit that guy in the ribs 10 times? Hit him in the ribs 10 times. But that's not going to bring the World Series back. That's not going to bring take a ring away. That's not going to change the past. There's nothing going to change. And you hitting a guy in the ribs for cheating, if you were on a last-place team, that doesn't make any difference for you. You weren't going to win anyway. So you trying to solve that by you just hitting people. See what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
Some things just need to be, hey, man, they got their hand slapped. They got in trouble. It was a conspiracy, whatever you want to call it. Move on. Because it's not going to change the past. And you're not really policing the game by hitting people for what they did with technology a couple years ago. The policing the game is like, hey, man, if I catch you tipping in a game, I'm going to hit you in the ribs, and I'm going to tell you to stop, and then you'll stop. You know, like that's kind of policing the game a little bit, but you're not policing the game by doing anything to them now. Like, that, it doesn't do anything.
So, yeah, it's in the past.
I don't see the point in it.
Right, you got to move on from it. One thing that did crack me up, Jeremy, is when Jim Crane, the owner of the Astros, said it had no impact, because anybody who's played the game, whether it be at the high level like you or any pitcher at any level, knows that it impacts the game. You know, how much does it, is my question to you. Because, yeah, I mean, you could have great stuff, but so much of it is that the hitter doesn't know what you're going to throw.
Oh, man, the hitters are so good, especially hitting fastballs. If they know what's coming, if you don't have to sit on a fastball because you know a breaking ball is coming, it's really easy to hit it. I mean, you might not hit it. You might not got a base hit. You hit on the screws, and your ability as a hitter to hit with better impact, homer, double, line drive, single, moving guys over, contact, is a lot better if you know what's coming. That doesn't mean you won't hit it to somebody from now. I'm not saying that. I mean, I think everybody in baseball pretty much knew I'm a 85% of the time. So that didn't mean they got hits on it. It's really tough to hit a sinker, right? But with nothing in the back of their head, if they say, okay, I know a curveball is coming from that ball, I'm a sick curveball, I don't worry about that sinker, my curveball is going to be pretty easy to either take for a ball or hit pretty hard. So to me, it does have impact. So for the owner to say that, one, that's just an – I would want to say it's an ignorant comment, but I think Mr. Crane has been around long enough to know that it will bring an impact. So I don't think ignorance has anything to do with it. I think it was just a bad comment to say, and he used it in it just wasn't wise to say it, because there's no truth to that.
Speaking of impact, one of the rules that's coming into play that's really going to have an impact is the three batter minimum, or you end the half inning for a pitcher. I heard you talking about this, Jeremy, and I totally agree that I think we're going to see a lot of players faking injury and illness.
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, that's going to be a strategy, and that's too bad. I mean, that really makes a sham of it. And I don't think that this should have been instituted. I think that, you know, you've got a roster of pitchers that are there for a reason, and now all of a sudden you're going to sort of, you know, change everything there. What were your thoughts about it? Do you think that we'll get used to it at some point?
I don't know if you're used to it. I think you just deal with it, but you're going to have to, it's going to happen. There are going to be guys that are like, you know, like I tweaked something or like, you know, something. It's just going to be what it is. There's going to be to where baseball, they might have to remove it, because you can have injuries like that that doesn't leave you out for very long. They can get you pulled out of a game, and you can't prove otherwise. You know, they'd say, hey, he felt something. He didn't want to push it. You know, we'll ice him down. It'll probably be better tomorrow. Like, that happens all the time, right? So, now if it happens to the same pitcher and the same sequence of pitchers every other game, I get that, right? I get that. But that doesn't mean in a big situation, in a really big game, that it's not going to happen. And so, for me, if you're going to sit there and say it's a three-batter minimum, well, I mean, then you better up the ability to carry more pitchers on the roster, so I have more options to go to for three batters. Like, you're not going to keep me down on the same number of pitchers that I need to use. Maybe, you know, you got a lefty specialist I use for one out, or and then move on and then go to the next guy. Well, then you better give me a more of a roster of guys that I can select from that can carry the ball longer, right, into some innings. And with baseball, I mean, Major League Baseball, it's going to backfire everywhere. So, okay, so now I got to face a three-player minimum. Well, now my contracts are going to be higher, because now I'm not facing one lefty at a time. Now I'm facing potentially an inning, so I might get more innings out of it, raises my contract status, my holds are up there. I mean, everything's going to change. So you're going to see it's going to all roll back downhill. It's going to impact the game all the way around, financially, strategically, skill wise, all that stuff is going to change, and I think that's where if you have a commissioner that, one, didn't play the game, two, is trying to be way too forward in advance in changing the rules of a game that's been around a really long time, the strategy about how the game is played, that's the impact that you're going to have. And so what they're trying to do to the game is to me, well, I can't believe that the players union agreed to it, to be honest with you. So I don't even agree with Tony and those guys, players union agreeing to any of that, because that's not okay. Because you have a guy on staff right now on the players union that wouldn't even have had a job to be on the players union because he wouldn't have had a career if he wouldn't have been a lefty specialist. If he had to face three guys at a time. So I don't understand how any of that could even be okay by the players union. So that whole thing to me is a mystery in and of itself.
Yeah, I mean, it would have eliminated a guy like Javi Lopez. Now, for you, I mean, you faced more of the right-handers, left-handers. You weren't just a lefty specialist. But, I mean, you know, Javi Lopez built a career really on that, right?
And it's a strategy that winning teams need. I mean, that guy was so important to the 2010, 12, and 14 World Series. I mean, how he was used and the strategy in which he was used. I mean, all of that, like, it literally changes a lot of the strategy that went into how we even won and how teams are winning. So a guy like Javi, he might not have a job, and now all of a sudden he was such an impact player. You're basically spitting in his face on that, saying, well, he wasn't that big of a deal. He was that big of a deal. And he was a big deal to the strategy on how people won and how teams won. And guys like him were very strategic in that, and that's super sad.
We'll take a trip down memory lane with Jeremy Affeldt right after this. We all know that solar systems make financial sense and environmental sense. And when it comes to choosing the best installation crew in the business, Sun First Solar should be your first choice. Sun First Solar has provided solar excellence since 1984. They are SunPower elite commercial and elite residential installers with a reputation for technical excellence, innovative design, fair pricing, excellent customer service, and end-to-end quality and competence. Sun First Solar is a family business devoted to treating their employees, customers, the community, and the environment with respect, and they are devoted to renewable energy and sustainability throughout the Bay Area. There is no roof or project that is too complicated. Sun First has successfully installed solar on Spanish tile roofs, metal roofs, and very steep roofs. They also have extensive experience in solar ground mounts and solar pool heating. Competitive pricing, expert consultation, and the best warranty. Go local and get your SunPower solar system from Sun First Solar today. Call Sun First Solar at 415-458-5870. That's 415-458-5870.
When it's time for new tires, you want the lowest prices and the best service, don't you? Well, Kane's Tire in San Rafael has you covered on both. Kane's has the lowest prices in Marin County, and they provide the warm and welcoming service that you can only receive from a family-run business. And this is a dependable family business that's been around for 61 years. Voted best of Marin for 35 years in a row, Kane's prices beat Costco's prices every time. Kane's Tire, 1531 4th Street in San Rafael. Give him a call at 415-453-2942. That's 415-453-2942 for Kane's Tire.
I want to take a trip down memory lane, and you guys are going to do that August the 16th if the schedule holds. There's a World Series reunion for the 2010 team, and I know you're really looking forward to that. One bit of controversy with that is that Aubrey Huff was not invited. He made some unacceptable comments on social media. They run counter to what the values of the Giants organization have. So what were your thoughts and other teammates that you've talked to about Huff not being invited?
Well, I mean, I think a lot of players are going to have opinions that are differing from the team they played on. So to me, that's not necessarily the big deal. But when you make it public and then you do it the way you did it, I could see how the team is like, you know what? Like, honestly, like, we can't – it's going to bring too much distraction to the situation. And the team doesn't want any more bad publicity. They had too much going on last year from all the stuff going on outside of the field in the front office, you know. So they had so much stuff going on. They don't need more of it. And so what they need to do is they got to say, hey, look, if you're going to continue to do that, and social media, whether people like it or not, is a voice. It is a voice that it becomes public and it leaves, and it can damage a lot of situations. So you got to be careful what you say, what you post, all that stuff on social media. So, I mean, and people read into a lot of stuff that you say on social media, all that stuff, right? So when you have all that going down and then you put out kind of the stuff that he put out, the team is like, you know what, it's not worth it because we want to try to have a reunion here and we're trying to celebrate something that it could get very distracted because people, fans, city, all those people might react to the person, not to the team. And that's what you need to stay away from. But you take the very opposite of that. When you brought Timmy in last year for Bochy's thing, when he walked out on the field, it lifted an entire stadium. I mean, that guy has had such great impact on San Francisco. So you see how the person can actually do a lot of good or a lot of bad for an entire team. And so what they were just trying to do, and I think that it was probably valuable at this point in time in this situation, is possibly to say, you know what, we have to forego that because we just don't think any other distractions right now is going to be needed. And they probably had to make I talked to a few guys in the front office about it and some ownership and they explained it to me and I completely understand and agree with what they did. It's just, you know, unfortunate for Aubrey. He doesn't get to celebrate with the team that he won a World Series with, but he kind of put himself in that position to do that. So,
yeah, I mean, I would imagine he's had these views for a long time, but was he divisive at all when he was part of the team?
He was always he was for the team. He was for the player. He protected the player. He was Aubrey, right? He was unfiltered, you know, to be honest with you. He's always been unfiltered. But when it came to his teammates, he protected you. So, I mean, he didn't let anything, you know, he knew what it was like to be a teammate. He knew it was like to he kind of had his own personality within the team and everybody accepted that. With the media, he was unfiltered and he kind of rubbed people the wrong way. But when it came to the team, we were all in it together at that point in time. He was not a problem by any means.
You know, you mentioned all the organizations you've played for. How different was that 2010 team? I mean, I know it was special. They won the first World Series in Giants history. You guys did. But you had guys like Pat Burrell, you know, Cody Ross comes in. It was a different group. So for you, how special was it in that way, just the personalities that you guys had?
Well, we had a lot of different personalities going. It was definitely, with Colorado, that was one of the close-knit teams I've been on. I mean, we went out to eat the dinner on the road. It was a really close team. And that was probably, up to that point, the most special team I've ever been on. 2010, I wouldn't say we were as close on the road going to dinner and stuff with everybody. We had people that hung out, but we didn't hang out as much of a group as Colorado did. But man, when you got to the field and you crossed those lines, I mean, we were as tight as it got. And we understood everybody's roles. We understood what each person could do. The personalities within the game and on the flights and stuff like that were fun. And people were laughing, having a good time. So, like, it was a very dynamic team. Wilson with the beard and all that stuff, right? So it was a really fun team to be a part of. And I really enjoyed it. I thought it was, you know, you look back on how winning teams win and what you need. In that situation, we had it. We had all of that. And I speak on how to have, produce in high-pressure situations and compete in high-pressure situations. And I used a lot of the Giants and what we did as a team to kind of almost show that. And I break down what each person did and how they did it and what they gave to a team and what they produced for a team. And I think that was what was important was the way that team was built and the way that our leader was leading that team. It showed me a lot on how people just should lead in teams, whether it be families or businesses and whatnot. So I feel like it was something that I learned a lot from. I was very proud to be a part of that team.
Now, you guys were never the favorites. I think about 2012 and, you know, game one of the World Series, I think most people thought the Tigers had a great shot to win that against the Giants. But right off the bat, Pablo Sandoval with the three-homer game hits two of them off Justin Verlander. I mean, it was just amazing how everybody stepped up. And was that something that maybe was a benefit that, you know, the outside world wasn't saying that the Giants were the favorites?
We were never the favorite. I think the only playtime we were kind of even somewhere with Kansas City, and that was just because we were both pretty matched up pretty even, you know. I think Texas and Detroit, neither team was a favorite in the 10 or 12 team were favorites. And I think it was because people look at power, right? Analysis, people look at, oh, home runs they have. And I would always laugh and be like, good pitching will break down good hitting any day of the week. It just will. And the advantage is to the pitcher, especially if he knows what he's doing. So we knew we could pitch. We knew we could take advantage of the holes and swings, especially Detroit that 8 days off. I've been a part of a situation like that at Colorado where I saw our hitters, how good they were, had 8 days off, and they just couldn't get their bats going because they had too many holes. Their bat speeds were dropped off. And I knew that I had to express that to some of the guys going into that Detroit series and what it's like. And you saw it. I mean, Prince Fielder had a big hole inside that he usually doesn't have, you know? I mean, Cabrera was swinging at balls below the zone, that hole down and in. If you could fade it, if you could drop some velocity off it that he can usually adjust to, but he was cheating so bad to get the fastball, he couldn't do it, you know? So there's so many different things like that. And we were coming off an incredible loser out series 2 times in a row, tons of momentum. Guys were locked in, focused, dealt with a ton of stress already, and we're competing in it. And so our bat speeds and our pitching was all locked in. And so when Verlander was coming, I remember, I think it was the second home run, he said, wow, like he couldn't believe that it happened. But, hey, man, like, we're ready. We're locked. Like, that's what we are. And I think that was Detroit. That was almost a nail in the coffin right away because they figured Verlander was going to win that game and off to a great start and beat him. And then it was like, uh-oh, right away for those Detroit players. What are we going to do now that our guaranteed guy just got beat? And I mean, you see how good Verlander's been in the World Series playoffs. I mean, he's been amazing. So to be able to beat a guy like that, it was pretty impressive. And I think that's what was so good about us is we didn't really care who we faced. We were so confident and we had so much going into that series that we were ready for anything.
You had great numbers in the postseason. I've read them off, 0.86 ERA in the postseason, World Series 0.77. And one of the best moments that you ever had was in Game 4 of that 2012 World Series. Eighth inning, you're in there, you got a tie game, you got a runner at first, you got nobody out, and you face Cabrera, Fielder, and Delmon Young, and you strike them out in succession. Tell us how you got that done.
Well, it was just, being focused. I knew the first batter that I had walked was a really close pitch on a 3-2 count on a corner, and it was actually really good at bat by that kid. And he took some really close pitches. But when you know you have your stuff, like I knew I had my stuff that day, even though I walked a guy in close pitches, I didn't feel like I didn't have my stuff. Sometimes when you walk a guy, it's like, man, I don't know where he's going today. But I had confidence in my stuff, and I was like, that guy got lucky because he could have got rung up right there, or I could have got him out, and he just kind of battled me, and I tipped my hat, but my stuff is there, and I knew it. I knew my sinker was good. I knew my curveball was good, and then so I just threw what I needed to throw, and I stayed focused on what I needed to throw. And when I struck out Fielder, on that fastball in, it was because I set him up with a really good curveball, and it even surprised me, to be honest with you. When I threw that curveball, I was like, I caught that ball back, and I was like, man, if I could figure out how to do that every time, I would. I don't even know how I threw that good of a curveball, but so I knew I could get him out in. But with Cabrera, that was just a split that cut. It looked like a slider, and I think he was reading split and thinking it was going to go the other way, and it went the opposite way of what he thought, the opposite way of what I thought it was going to go, and the opposite way of what Buster thought it was going to go. To be honest with you, Buster said he was just glad he caught it. So. It was, it was one of those things where you just had so much movement, so much stuff, and it was so cold. The hitters were not locked in. We knew it. So you just knew you had to pound the strike zone, stay ahead in the count, keep them defensive, and see what happens. And that's kind of what we did, and that's what I did. And striking guys out, I didn't really try to do that. I was trying for a double play the entire time after walking that first guy. So I just kind of made pitches that I thought I could get double plays on, and I actually got swings and misses. So that's pretty much what happened there.
Let's go to Game 7 of the 2014 World Series. You come in second inning. You go 2 1/3 innings, end up getting the win in that Game 7. And when you were in there in the bottom of the third inning, I was actually watching this game last night. We're all watching different things because we're sitting here at home. And I watched the whole game. And one of the things that I noticed, Jeremy, you'll remember, is that you threw over to first base a few times with Hosmer up there and Lorenzo Cain at first base. And I thought that ended up being important. You got that double play, the Joe Panic flip out of the glove double play. But, that could have been a really close play at second base, but you're keeping the runner close. How important is that?
Well, it's really important, especially for me, because I'm like a 1-9 to home plate, which is not good. So I knew I had to keep him close. And Cain, he was such a good base runner and a good base stealer. And in a World Series, in a game like that, you let the pressure work for you. So they could think, oh, I could steal off this guy. Yeah, you could steal off me, but I could also pick over. And the risk is, well, if I risk and I steal off him and he picks over and I get picked off at second, I just took this out of a situation for a go-ahead run. So you know that's in the back of their head. So if you pick over a few times, do different looks, it keeps them a little bit more unsure than usual because the game means more, right? The game seven means a ton. So you knew that you were using some of that pressure to your advantage. I was just trying to let them know, you might be able to steal this bag on me. I think you definitely could, but I could also pick over. And the odds are I'm not, but if I do. You know, so you're playing that mind game with him. And so you were just trying to do the best you could. But then I also have to worry about the hitter because he's a lefty, but he's really good. And with Hosmer hitting, you didn't want to leave it. And I actually left it probably too much out of it. It was an inside sinker that was elevated and probably catch as far in as I wanted it to catch. And so he ended up hitting it up the middle. And I just was thankful that Panic made the play he made. And obviously Crawford has got a cannon at short. And so he was able to, you know, pretty much take care of business there. And we still had to go to a replay on it, you know. And the only camera that showed he was out was the small, minute camera that's in front of the bag. And that was the only reason they overruled it and called him out, was because of that camera that's usually not even in a situation other than the World Series. So there's a lot of things that went in our favor there, but it was also using the pressure. It was also using the pressure of the game to keep guys unsure of what's really going to happen, which allows them to maybe not be as aggressive, especially on the base paths, as they would want to be in a normal game.
Did you think Panic was going to get there? I mean, that ball was hit pretty hard, and I mean, that was a great timing stop.
Yeah, and I actually, when he hit it, I thought about going after it, and I pulled my glove back, and then I was like, oh, that ball's hit too hard. And then you look, and he's there. So I literally thought, oh, man. You know, like that. I thought that ball, the only thing is you have a chance if you're thinking the whole thing double play depth, right? Like, okay, we're in double play depth. And honestly, I don't think we started shifting as bad as we started shift. 2015 is when we started getting really bad with shifts, and I hated it. And I did not like pitching the shifts. Because I didn't pitch to a location. I pitched to my sinker, and I was let the ball hit on the ground where it gets hit on the ground, and you can't guarantee it. So for me, I hated shifts for that reason, especially over shifts. That situation there, we were playing more of a standard double play depth, and I think it allowed him to not be overshifted in that situation, and so he could get to it. If we were overshifted like you are now, he never gets to it because the second baseman is nowhere near, and the shortstop, he might be able to get to it, but you can't turn a double play because there's no one at second base. He's overshifted.
Right,
so, to be honest with you, I absolutely hate shifts. But that one right there with pinching up the middle, the standard double play scenario that you're supposed to have, it worked perfect. And like I said, thankfully, Panic took the right angle. He had to have a quick first step to get to it. It was hit pretty hard. He read it right off the bat, and it was a play that pretty famous play, actually, if you think about it.
Yeah, one of the best plays that you'll see in the World Series. And the first successful manager challenge in World Series history. How about that? I mean, waited a long time, too. That was a long challenge.
Yep. Oh, yeah, because they had to check all the different cameras. And like I said, they didn't have – none of them proved it. And until that one button camera.
Before I let you go, the interview after Game 7, you were emotional. I mean, that was Kansas City, a place where you pitched early in your career. You had that great outing. I mean, that's three World Series rings. Is that something that you think about a lot, just what was running through your veins there after that game? You know, the way Madison Bumgarner took the baseball and went five innings to finish that off. I mean, it had to be, you know, just so nerve-wracking to watch that after you came out of the game to see Mad Bum get that done. How often do you think about it?
I think about it from time to time. You know, I think for one, I didn't even realize I was so in on that deal that I was so focused that I'm actually been more nervous now. I've seen that game a little bit on TV and sometimes watching it. I'm more nervous. I'm watching it and I'm like, I know what happens and I'm nervous. I wasn't that nervous pitching in the game. I think you're just so focused on what you're doing. You don't understand the pressure until it's done. You know, when I was done pitching and Madison took the ball, I felt very confident in having the ball. But I was still really nervous, and it was a nerve-wracking situation not being in the game. I actually was like, I'd rather be pitching right now. I'd be way less nervous. So it definitely was an all-around, you know, intense game for everybody. But it was something I'm very, very thankful I got to be a part of, and I definitely feel honored that I got to be part of that game in that situation because I don't think – and no one can take it from from me, no one can take it from anybody who played in that situation. And we played that, 2014 was definitely was super intense. 2012, you know, the NLCS, NLDS, 2014 World Series. I mean, you couldn't be in any more high pressure situations than we were put in those three situations over those 2 years. That I don't think any baseball player has. I would be shocked if you could show me statistically any other team that was put in the pressure that we were put in and succeed the way we did.
Yeah, it was an amazing run that you guys had. And Jeremy, thanks so much for doing this. And not only that, I want to thank you again for all of your interviews that you did with us here on this podcast for 5 years, really. Every homestand, I would come over to your locker. You always said yes. You always said yes. And that is so appreciated. You really helped out a lot.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate that.
That's former Giants lefty Jeremy Affeldt. Much thanks to him. And we look forward to more podcasts throughout the coronavirus shelter-in-place situation. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll talk to you again next week on Inside China Basin on thesportsvirus.com.